The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day one of this five-day sesshin, our first sesshin here in 2015 at Hidden Valley Zen Center. And I'd like to share with you something of the early practice years of an eminent Rinzai master. He died, I think it was in 1997, of cancer in Japan. He was Japanese. His name is Morinaga Soko Roshi, and he was quite an important but very low-key Zen master in the Rinzai lineage. His temple was a sub-temple of Ryutaku-ji, which is not Ryutaku-ji, Ryo-an-ji, two dragon temples. Second one, a peaceful dragon temple in Kyoto, which has the famous rock garden, Zen rock garden, which in photographs looks enormous, but in actuality it's about a quarter of the size of this room. And his sub-temple was Daishuin of that temple. He had a number of Western students, and one of them, a woman actually, a German woman, became his only Dharma successor. I sat with them a few times in Kyoto in 1992, including one day when Soko Roshi was having tea with his students. In a very small room, crowded with students that he likened to Vimalakirti's bedroom. Vimalakirti is one of the most famous, one of the three most famous lay practitioners in Buddhist history. And he was living in the time of the Buddha and was deeply realized and was a big challenge to all of the Buddha's senior disciples, because he would encounter them in various places and challenge them in their practice. And the whole premise of the Vimalakirti Sutra is that Vimalakirti is ill, and the Buddha is urging his disciples, asking for one of his disciples, represent him, to go and call on Vimalakirti. And one by one, the disciples express their reluctance to go and say, oh, please don't do it to me this time, because when I saw him last, he bested me in the Dharma, and this is what happened, and I was mortally embarrassed, and so on and so forth. The whole thing is a very deep teaching on Zen and the nature of mind and the nature of illusion. And finally, Manjusri, who is the Buddha's most senior disciple, the one who stands for wisdom, says, I will go and call on Vimalakirti on behalf of you. And now all the other disciples want to go because they want to see this big show between Manjusri and Vimalakirti. And it is indeed quite a big show, because Vimalakirti is in this tiny little room where there's nothing but Vimalakirti, his bed, and a little bit of space around him. And somehow an infinite number of beings manages to crowd into that room. And Morinaga Soko Roshi commented that the tea that morning in that very small room crowded with people was like Vimalakirti's bedroom. The reason why Morinaga Soko Roshi's story is so inspiring to us is that he went through some of the same kinds of difficulties that many Zen practitioners go through in their early years. And one can take hope from this, because by the time I met Morinaga Roshi. He was in his 60s, early 60s. He wasn't very old when he died. And he was an impressive human being. Impressive in his humility, in his clarity, in his embrace of all life. Something that a true teacher of Zen would hopefully be able to express completely and genuinely. But it was a long, hard row for him to get there. And let me start by sharing you his story in his own words as translated by Belinda, who was a student of his and who also was the translator for Tangen Roshi at Bukkokuji. It is, in this particular case, the part that I'll share with you is a chapter in a book called Zen Tradition and Transition, which was put together by a friend of mine, Dharma brother Kenneth Kraft, who's a university professor and fluent in Japanese, and was a student of Morinaga Soko Roshi's himself. One of the things about Morinaga Roshi was that he set up a tall barrier for his students. He would not accept any students who were not fluent in Japanese. And he had a small group of Western students who learned Japanese in order to be able to train with him. So here is his story. I was born in Uotsu on the Japan Sea and was a liberal arts student at Toyama High School when the Second World War was at its height. At first, all high school pupils were exempt from conscription until they left school. However, when the war situation worsened, an imperial edict was issued summoning liberal arts students to the front. Apparently, the reasoning behind this was that science pupils might make a positive contribution to the war by their future study of medicine and natural sciences, whereas liberal arts pupils were more likely to upset the national spirit with their argumentative theories. And in Japan, that would have been a real concern. All of us know that we will die someday. But do we know, really, that we'll die someday, or do we just have an idea because we've been told and because everywhere around us we can see that people live to a certain length of time and then they die. But is it a real sense for each one of us? Or is it something that, someday I'll die when I'm old? And yet it can happen to young people. It happened to old people, and it happens to everyone. In the process of our Zazen, we practice dying. We may not be aware of it, but that's what we're really doing, although not necessarily for the purpose of practice dying. But each time we extend our out-breath, giving ourselves fully to the experience and the curiosity, who are we really? We are letting go of something else, something we'd otherwise be thinking of, something we'd otherwise be dreaming of, and more subtly and more importantly, a self-image. Because do we really know who we are? Last night in the opening talk, I spoke of how we upholster ourselves with experiences, ideas, assumptions, and create a self-image that we then spend a good part of the rest of our life, unless we are Zen students and work hard to find out the truth. We spend the rest of our life defending, needing to uphold, and it causes all manner of difficulty, pain and suffering. In extreme, what we recently read of, the massacre of the journalists in the Charlie Hebdo offices in Paris, because they had frequently, apparently, or at least certainly more than once, posted cartoons of Muhammad, the saint who founded the Muslim religion. And in the Muslim religion, it is considered quite inappropriate to picture anyone. This is why writing has reached such a decorative art in the Islamic world, because they're not allowed images. And in a way, that would fit with Buddhism. We're trying to let go of our images, not add more on. To continue with Morinaga Roshi. All of us know that we will die someday, perhaps tomorrow, perhaps in 20 or 30 years' time. What makes life and peace of mind possible is the fact that we don't really know when death will come. And in not really knowing, we would add, that we think maybe it won't happen anyway. But awaiting the arrival of our call-up papers, we students suddenly felt we were staring death in the face. Think about this. These are high school kids, 16, 17, 18 years old, and they're being called up to be trained as kamikaze pilots. When one goes out on a kamikaze mission, it's guaranteed that one's not going to get back. Because the whole point in this devil wind, which is a translation of kamikaze, god wind, god in the sense of the Shinto gods, is that you're going to take your airplane and turn it into a weapon of destruction. And of course, the pilot's going to be destroyed as part of that process. So each of these young high school guys is knowing that within perhaps only months they were going to be sending their airplane smashing into the side of a foreign ship, trying to create as much death and destruction as possible. How would it feel to be facing that within a few months in your young life? Every day I seemed to be treading air. Whether awake or asleep, I kept thinking about my own death in action. But it was too late to look for philosophical or religious answers to the question of death. The young men who entered the services found a makeshift answer in their misgivings by blindly convincing themselves that it was a just war for which they could not begrudge the sacrifice of their own lives. I did so too. We believed that the economically developed nations of Europe and America had been exploiting the East for a long time, and our country had risen up against this oppression and was waging a just and meaningful war of liberation, a cause which well merited, if need be, our own bodies being smashed to pieces. So my classmates and friends climbed into airplanes fueled for a one-way mission to certain death. With their favorite philosophy book or Shinran's passages deploring deviations of faith, placed beside their joysticks, they went off to plunge down on the enemy ships. Many of them were shot down and crashed into the sea before they could accomplish their mission. And then after Japan's unconditional surrender on August 15, 1945, we were told our country had conducted a war of aggression and evil, and that the war leaders were to be executed. So, from going to believing that that war that they were about to lose their own lives in, give their own lives for, was something that was important for all humanity, was vital, was helpful, was saving. And suddenly to find out it had been a war of aggression that Japan had started, and that there were terrible atrocities committed by Japan, not only in that war, but in previous wars.
Surely before that.
The end of the wars found me still alive, and I was soon demobilized. Somehow I got hold of a multiband radio and listened to broadcasts about the German war trials, which, by the way, Kepler Roshi was the head court reporter on. The court reporter being the person that takes all the notes, verbatim notes in shorthand of exactly who said what and exactly what happened in the trial. That was how he was introduced to Zen, really, because he was first in Germany at the trials in Nuremberg, and of course was shocked to hear of the atrocities committed there. And then he went to Japan and was equally shocked by how different the attitude of the Japanese people was. That the Japanese people hung their heads in shame when they realized what the war really had been. They apologized. And during his off moments, when he wasn't in court, Kepler Roshi would find himself in the gardens of the temples and was struck by the deep sense of peace in those gardens. We have something of that here at Hidden Valley Zen Center. There's a deep sense of peace in the Zendo, which is embracing and comes out of the Zazen of many, many, many people over many, many, many years. This temple was founded in the 1960s. We can tune into that sense of energy, be embraced by it, and let it help draw us deeper within. And even now I can hear ringing in my ears the echo of that voice pronouncing the words, "To be hanged." Newsreels were also shown, probably a policy determined by the American Army of Occupation. I could not help but feel sickened by the sight of German generals hanged in the public square amidst the stares of huge crowds and by the scenes of the Italian leader Mussolini and his lover dangling head down from a wire noose and then being dragged around the streets with everyone cursing them and hurling stones. One by one, we students returned to school clad in government surplus uniforms, but for all of us who had lived until then with no firm beliefs, the big question was how to distinguish between good and evil. We pondered and discussed this matter day after day. And that is also Kepler Roshi's question that brought him to Zen practice. First, to Zen students, becoming a Zen student at Columbia University in the classes of D.T. Suzuki, but also eventually going to Japan and training in Japan at an era when it was very, very difficult for anyone to survive in Japan, much less a foreigner. Why is there suffering in the world? Why? The year before the war ended, I had lost both my parents in one blow. The shock of my mother's death proved too great for my seriously ill father. He died in a coma the following morning. My call-up papers had already arrived, and I had barely 2 days in which to rush the funeral through and settle my affairs before I entered the army. For generations, my family had been landowners and had let the small amount of land we possessed to tenant farmers. Father used to say to me, "There's nothing more reliable than land. Fire won't burn it, floods won't wash it away, and robbers won't carry it off. So whatever you do, at least make sure you don't part with the land." But the post-war land reform program took the family land away. There was nothing left I could trust. All I had believed to be secure turned out to be transitory. And that is indeed the truth. There is nothing that can be counted on in this life. It sounds like a very depressing statement. But given that human beings are tremendously resourceful and have an inborn capacity for compassion and wisdom, if we can come to awakening, and by this I don't mean a superficial kensho, I mean very deeply coming to awakening, we will find ourselves free of that problem. Still, everything is transitory. But we're no longer identified with a somebody that has to have things a certain way, or they're not happy. It's the ultimate inflexibility, and the freedom is incalculable. A simple freedom, not to be caught in a self-identity, but to be able to move freely in response to circumstances without having to stand stiff and rigid in a belief, in an idea, in a sense of self. This is what is offered to each one of us. We all have it inborn. We all have the potential to come to the awakening that will make that life possible, our only true life. And here you have the further gift of having affinity with the Dharma, the teachings, the possibility, the ability of being able to come to Sesshin to do concentrated practice, guidance with a teacher, with two teachers. Your karma is certainly a positive one. Make good use of it. Further, as a result of a post-war measure to freeze bank deposits, not a yen was available for the insurance my father had bought to safeguard his children. Yet prices rose rapidly. What could be bought one day for 1 yen cost 10 the next day and soon over 100. As students in those days did not do part-time work, I had no idea how to go about earning money with my own two hands. So I lost both an ethical standard by which to live and the financial means with which to support myself. And suddenly he found himself homeless. In my utter misery, it would not have been surprising if I'd joined some gang of criminals or hurled myself under a train. Though I'd managed to finish high school, I felt no inclination to go on to a university. Instead, I just idled away my time feeling miserable. And after quite a while, it suddenly struck me that the real reason I no longer knew what to do with my life was that I'd only read books and theorized about things without ever imposing any discipline on myself. This strange set of circumstances eventually prompted me to knock at the gates of several Zen temples, and one day I was led to Goto Zigan Roshi, master of Daishuin Temple in Kyoto, which temple he, Morinaga Soko, eventually became the master of. Goto Roshi had been head abbot of Myoshinji Temple and later of Daitokuji Temple and had now retired. I presented myself before him sloppily, dressed with unkempt hair. His first words were, "Why have you come here?" The reply went on and on about everything that had happened to me. The Roshi heard me out in silence for over an hour without once interrupting. Can any of us here do that? Listen to somebody crying about themselves, complaining, Could we listen for an hour to that without getting impatient, without interrupting, without getting argumentative? Well, you should have done whatever. Think about it. When I'd gotten it all off my chest, he said, I've listened to what you said, and it seems to me you've lost faith in everything and everybody. However, Zen training is impossible if you don't trust your teacher. Can you trust me? If you can, I'll take you on just as you are. But if you can't, it would be a waste of time and you'd be better off going home. I think in our present society we've forgotten that when it comes to learning something, trust in one's teacher is absolutely essential, whether you're a Zen master or a university professor. So we don't trust, we can't be open to learning from that person. And if we can't be open to learning, we're going to stay stuck wherever we're at. However, I was a complete good-for-nothing without integrity, and so despite the Roshi's venerable 70 years of age, I thought to myself, this silly old man may well have been the abbot of Myoshinji and Daitokuji for all I care, but the world is full of impostors in high positions. How can he expect me to put my whole trust in him? I've only just met him. If it were that simple, I would have trusted someone or believed something before and not need to come here. However, the most important thing then was to be allowed to stay, even if it meant lying. So I said, I trust you. Please take me on. Come along with me, the Roshi said. And the first task I was given was to sweep the garden with a bamboo broom. And that is a lot more challenging than it would seem. This bamboo broom is a broom that is made with a bamboo handle and a bunch of twigs tied to the, actually they're quite long twigs, maybe 2-3 feet long, although over time they get worn down. And you have to sweep in a way that gently directs the surface of the earth in a decorative pattern and doesn't give you a wad of trash, dug up moss, little pieces of moss, stones, and other things in a way. So if we're honest, we have to admit that our innermost motives are often extremely petty. While still thinking of him as a silly old man for expecting me to trust him, I somehow wanted to win the Roshi's approval. So I grasped my broom and swept mightily and soon had a mountain of leaves, and I asked Roshi, where should I put all this rubbish? Hoping he would see how good I'd been. He immediately roared, these are not rubbish. I started to say, that's all very well, but over here. And he replied, you don't trust me, do you? Go to the shed and bring an empty charcoal sack you'll find there. Coming back, I found the Roshi vigorously raking through the pile of leaves so that any stones or gravel fell to the bottom, and he then took the sacks and filled them to the very last leaf, packing them tightly with his feet. Now, go put these back in the shed, he said. They're kindling for the bath fire. When I carried the sacks back to the shed, I realized that the leaves were not rubbish after all, but I was still convinced that the remaining bits and pieces were. However, when I came back, I saw the Roshi squatting on the ground, picking out the small stones from what remained. When he'd carefully gathered them together to the tiny last pebble, he said, now, put these beneath the eaves. A lot of Japanese Zen temples and the more traditional older houses don't have rain gutters. The water just drips off the eaves, and they have what would be called a ground gutter at the ground level below where the water would drip, and they're usually a narrow area, long line filled with stones. Otherwise it would erode the earth as it does a little bit out here where we have taken off the gutters that we used to have on this building. The raindrops dripping from the roof had made depressions in the gravel beneath the eaves, and I used the pebbles to fill these holes. And I had to admit to myself that the stones looked attractive there, but I was still quite sure that the remaining lumps of earth and scraps of moss could serve no useful purpose. Yet the Roshi just collected them together without fuss and placed them in the palm of his hand. Searching patiently, he put the lumps of earth into depressions in the ground and then firmed them in with his foot until nothing remained. And he said, "Now, do you understand a little? Originally, there is no rubbish in either men or things. Originally, there is no rubbish either in men or in things." And here, this men relates to humanity. He could have said, "Originally, there is no rubbish in human beings or in things." Can we have such a broad view? Can we understand that the person who just cut us off on the freeway and brought a rise of anger into our throat is not a piece of trash? Well, the behavior isn't ideal. The being is a perfect being. Can we see that? Can we see that? And when we encounter somebody that to us looks disgusting, can we see that when somebody, a roommate, a spouse, a friend, says something that is irritating? In human beings and in things, there is no rubbish. It's a very deeply enlightened view. This was the first teaching I received from Zuigan Roshi. Roshi's words that originally there is no rubbish either in men or in things actually comprise the basic truth of Buddhism. According to the traditional accounts, the Buddha taught, "How marvelous, how wonderful. All sentient beings are perfect and without flaw." Perfect and without flaw. It is only due to delusive attachments that the truth cannot be seen. And this is why we practice, to see that truth, to live up to that truth. To manifest the perfect being that we are, that we always ever were from the very beginning. It's not like we have to make ourselves better. It's a matter of uncovering who we really are. And I think that's enough for today. We'll continue with Morinaga Soko Roshi's story tomorrow. Thank you for listening. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.